welcome into Studio 2 on this spring Wednesday afternoon. I'm Cherry Gregg.
It is spring. Good point. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. On the show today, we're going to reframe the immigration debate with the help of a professor from the Wharton School, Zeke Hernandez, who has an upcoming book called The Truth About Immigration. It debunks a lot of myths about immigration, and it basically makes the argument that our society needs immigrants, lots of immigrants. And so we're going to talk with Zeke Hernandez about his research, which collates a lot of other research, and it should be a fascinating conversation.
Yeah, especially with the whole debate about immigration being a hot topic. And it's been one for weeks, and the rhetoric is going negative. So I'm looking forward to that conversation. Yeah.
Also, I know you're looking forward to our closing conversation today with a hip-hop dance pioneer and Philadelphia native, Rennie Harris.
Yes.
Who, if you don't know the name, you should get familiar with the name, because Rennie Harris is like the guy in the world of hip-hop choreography.
Yeah, one of the pioneers of the hip-hop dance movement, is the founder of the oldest and longest running hip-hop dance company.
Yep. So,
taking hip-hop music from the streets to the stage. And they have a show this weekend.
So
we're going to have them on the show. Looking forward to that.
Questions or comments on either of those topics, email us, studio2@whyy.org, or give us a call, 888-477-9499. Before we get into our news segment, I do have to circle back on something we talked about yesterday. Okay. I mentioned that we did the spelling bee here over the weekend.
You were the host.
I was the pronouncer.
Third year in a row.
And I mentioned that the student that won, a fourth grader, the championship word that he spelled was topazolite. And I asked if anyone in our audience could spell it. And we got several submissions.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, by the way.
Like, listening
I do.
And emailing. We love you.
We do love you. Unfortunately, you're all wrong. You were all bested by a fourth grader. So topazolite is, a lot of you understood, the root of it was topaz, T-O-P-A-Z, and it ends with L-I-T-E. But the transitional vowel, it doesn't sound like it, is an O.
And they kept putting A.
Yeah, or E.
Or E, oh.
One person got it right, and it was our producer, who's on maternity leave, Paige Marie Bessler. So congratulations, Paige. Everyone else got it wrong.
Well, you know, that means that Jaden is still the reigning champ. I mean, you know.
The champ of Philly and the champ of Studio 2.
Exactly. So now we're going to jump into the news for today.
And something else we talked about yesterday.
Exactly. Yeah. Congressman, remember the Congressman Andy Kim, who's running for U.S. Senate in New Jersey? He's challenged the century-old ballot system that benefits candidates endorsed by party officials. He got support from the New Jersey AG, Matt Plankin, who said he won't defend it. But now the latest development, and sorry to bury the lead, in a rare move, top lawmakers in the Garden State, they follow suit. They have vowed to rework the county line ballot system.
Yep.
So
things are moving.
Yeah. In a rare joint statement this week, the leading members of the state legislature from both parties, they said that they are going to use the legislative process because this is a legislative issue and they're going to do what they can to fix this problem. No one knows when they'll do it. No one knows what the fix will look like. Yeah. But they said they're going to step up. Critics are saying, look, you know, they have egg on their face. You know, they knew that this was going to be, you know, a judge stepping in and they were going to lose. And so now they're stepping up. But, you know, it seems like this New Jersey, which has the only county line ballot system in the country, that this could be coming to an end.
You used the phrase, and I don't think you meant this as a pun, followed suit.
Yes.
They literally did follow
the lawsuit
suit here.
Yeah.
There was a lawsuit, and they have been pressured to take some action. We don't know what the action will be, but
we shall see.
Stay tuned. Also, in the world of politics and primaries and ballots, Delaware announced that it will not hold its presidential primary this April, which will save the state $1.5 million, reportedly. That is because they have determined that there's really no reason to do this. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump will be the Republican nominee, and Joe Biden will be the Democratic nominee.
No challengers, yeah.
No challengers. As you might have thought. Wait a second. How are they canceling the whole primary? Aren't there other people running for other offices? Well, in Delaware, that's not the case. They actually decouple the presidential primary from all of the other office primaries. That primary is in September in Delaware. So like gubernatorial, state house, state senate, et cetera. So they just had this standalone competition for presidential. That's now canceled. September is still going. However, I will note that there is a movement within Delaware to bring these two primary dates together to, you know, eliminate confusion and to, you know, boost, to, you know, voter turnout.
Yeah. And, you know, and I lived in Delaware for a period of time, and that was a little confusing to me because I've always been in states where they are coupled. And so you have one primary day, but Delaware is a little bit different. I think it makes fiscal sense to save that kind of money when, I mean, there was no one, there was no challenges that to be had. It was just like we knew who the nominees were going to be for all parties. So
let's move it
along.
Let's
move it along. Yeah.
People in Philadelphia are often decoupled from their cars.
Yes, they... Ooh, Avi, you're getting so good. Yes.
Can you take us to that story
and,
now?
Mayor Parker has a proposal within her budget plan that would include money for software that would help people find their cars if those cars are moved because of a courtesy tow. Has your car ever been moved because of a courtesy tow?
Thank God it has not.
Mine has. It's a pain.
Yeah.
They will move your car to someplace, but you call and they don't know where it is. So this $225,000 proposal.
To be clear, they take your car.
Yes.
They tow it. They don't know where they towed it to.
And you, it's up to you to find it.
You just got to go look.
It's up to you to find it. And the other part, and the Inquirer did an investigation a while back showing that if they moved your car to another place where it could be towed, your car could be moved from a safe place to an unsafe place and then towed or ticketed, and you still have to get your car to tow or pay the ticket. It's kind of wild. But this software, which costs about $225,000 and is part of the budget proposal, would help you go on a little link and find your car quickity quick. Boom, boom.
Quickity quick. But it might not apply to all courtesy tows.
No, that's true.
If third party contractors are involved. So it's maybe a mini fix, not a complete fix.
Yeah.
But I'll take a mini fix.
And of course, city council still has to vote on the proposal. But This will fix an issue that has affected so many.
One more story today. This is from The Atlantic. We like this little think piece in The Atlantic about the end of babysitting.
Yeah.
The argument is that babysitting, specifically babysitting by neighborhood teenagers, is fading away. Why might that be? Why aren't teenagers being asked to babysit neighborhood kids anymore?
I don't know.
So this think piece by Faith Hill in The Atlantic, not the singer, this is a writer named Faith Hill, cites the rise of professionalized childcare, the lack of avenues for teens to develop sort of job skills and participate in the workforce. The teen workforce participation has been dropping over the decades, and also an intensive parenting trend, basically parents being a little bit too precious and not trusting local teens with their kids' well-being for a couple of hours. Babysitting was a big part of my childhood, yours as well. I watched my neighbor's kids, and I was like
$30 12. A week for like 2 years.
What did you spend that on?
I don't know. Movies.
Don't want to
bubble say. Gum. I don't know. I have no idea. But it was like my first job.
Yeah.
At like 12 years old, was babysitting the neighbor's kid.
People don't trust 12 and 13-year-olds anymore. And I do think there has been a societal shift in the way that we think about teens and tweens and sort of how far along the developmental curve they are. I think we see them as younger maybe today than we would have.
And I was considered to be fairly responsible. And, you know, my babysitter was another 13-year-old when I was a kid.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But, you know, I know we're going to wrap this up, but this article got me thinking about one of my favorite childhood movies back from the 1987 film. It was called Adventures in Babysitting. It's the place where I fell in love with solo dance parties. In this song that we're going to play as we leave this segment, stars Elizabeth Shue. She's having a solo dance party, dreaming about her high school crush right before he cancels the date. And then she ends up being a babysitter of a couple kids, but she's dreaming about
and
him.
And the plot continues from there.
It goes from there. And it's worth watching again.
Two thumbs up, five stars.
Double thumbs up. Okay. It takes me back. I just love this one. It's one of my favorite movies.
Bring back babysitting.
Bring it back.
This is Studio 2. We have a very different conversation coming up on the other side of this break. You will want to hear it, but I'm going to let you hear this song first. You're listening to WHYY.
supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolf-Manarit.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We're going to talk about immigration now. It's an issue that is constantly in the news. Just yesterday, a Texas immigration law that would make illegal border crossings a state crime and allows Texas officials to apprehend and deport undocumented immigrants, well, it was blocked again. The conservative majority on the U.S. Supreme Court had ruled that the law could go into effect on Tuesday, but hours later, a federal appeals court order put it on hold.
Back and forth. And of course, the immigration issue is also at the forefront of the presidential election. Just over the weekend, former President Trump stoked fears again about our southern border, using dehumanizing language to describe migrants. But while there's a lot of rhetoric and worry about undocumented migrants, what's the real impact of immigration on our economy and culture? Wharton professor Zeke Hernandez argues in a forthcoming book that overwhelmingly immigrants are a boon for America. His book is called The Truth About Immigration, and we invited him to share that truth here today on Studio 2. Zeke Hernandez, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you have a comment or question about the immigration debate and the effect of immigrants on our economy, call us, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
And so, Zeke, we want to start the conversation because you argue in your book that much of the American rhetoric around immigrants, specifically those who come here as undocumented people, that it paints immigrants as villains or victims. You argue that both depictions are unfair, negative assessments of newcomers to this country. I want you to lay out what you see as the truth.
Well, yeah, what you label as the villain argument is a lot of what we're hearing in the political rhetoric, that immigrants take our jobs, that they undermine our culture, that they threaten our safety. But interestingly, most of us haven't really imbibed a good counter argument to that.
Yeah.
If you think about it, while we love Emma Lazarus's poem about the poor huddled masses, actually, it's done quite a disservice, because a poor huddled mass is like someone to be pitied, someone who might cost us a lot to help. But it turns out that the facts don't show that. So the poor huddled masses argument isn't a counterargument to the villain narrative. So the truth about immigration is that immigrants are net positive contributors to everything you want for your community to be prosperous. Job creation, investment, cultural vitality, innovation, you name it, whatever's on your wish list, immigrants contribute positively to it. And that's a fact. That's not just opinion. The evidence shows that really clearly.
What's so interesting, and you lay this out in the beginning of your book, is that you're born in a different country. You're from South America.
Correct.
When you were thinking about coming to America, you had so imbibed, as you say, those counter arguments about immigration that you were hesitant to come here because you thought you'd be taking a spot from a native born American. Explain your personal journey and how it feeds into your thesis.
I came to the U.S. to study. I actually had received a scholarship to come study at a university. And I had several American friends. And one of them said to me, and he didn't say this to me in a malicious way, but he said, you know, if you come, you're going to steal a scholarship and a job and probably a girl from a deserving American.
Mm.
And I wasn't angry. I actually thought he's probably right. Immigration might be good for me, but maybe I'm doing harm. And I had a kind of a raging internal debate about whether I should come because I was very worried.
You felt real guilt about this.
I did. And it has been a journey of many years to realize that there was nothing to worry about. But so when people worry about immigrants, I get it because I worried about being an immigrant myself.
And I want to go back a little bit before we start going through all the misconceptions and the myths about immigration, because there is a history in this country of villainizing newcomers, whether they be the Italians, Irish, Jewish, Chinese. Can you walk us through some of this history and the origins of this negative sentiment?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because there's always an argument about, oh, this new wave of immigrants is different, right? And they're really going to hurt us. And that's what one of our leading presidential candidates is arguing right now. But it's always been that way. The first group that spooked Americans were the Irish, and the Irish were supposed to never assimilate. They were Catholic. They wouldn't accept the Constitution. They'd be loyal to the Pope. The Irish have done fine, right?
Yeah.
Then it was the Chinese who came to build the Transcontinental Railroad. And actually, our first immigration exclusion law in the U.S., 1882, was to exclude Chinese workers under the argument that they threatened American workers. That turns out not to be true. Then it was Germans, right? The Germans were different. They weren't Protestant. They were Lutheran. They spoke a different language. They started German schools. And even our beloved Benjamin Franklin here in Philadelphia sort of made arguments about Germans. Of course, that was, you know, years before the time I'm talking about. But people were spooked by them. And then it was the Scandinavians. Now the real turning point in American history that like completely freaked out the establishment happened around 1890 when you stopped having Western and Northern Europeans coming and you started having Southern and Eastern Europeans. So all of a sudden you have Italians, Poles, Greeks, Ukrainians who were Jewish, Catholic, and this created a panic that resulted by 1924 in the National Origins Act, which shut the door on immigration for essentially 40 years. Mm-hmm. Immigrants went from being 15% of our national population to less than 5%, which is a gigantic decline. And the argument was these Southern and Eastern Europeans can't handle democracy. Asians, by the way, were banned completely. They can't handle democracy. They're too different. And, you know, today it's Latin Americans and Asians. So it's always been that, you know, supposedly the most recent wave is inferior, unassimilable. And if you look at the historical evidence, every group has done just fine, right? Today we have the descendant of a German-American, our leading candidate for the Republican Party, arguing that Latin Americans and Asians can't assimilate when 100 years ago people were making that very argument about his own predecessor. So, you know, it's
fascinating.
It's interesting. Yeah.
Let's talk about the economic impact, because one of the main arguments you hear from folks who are against immigration or want to restrict immigration is that immigrants destabilize the labor force, cause wages to fall, or in layman's terms, take jobs from native born Americans. What does the research actually say?
The short answer is it's exactly the opposite is true, right? And we let's split it into why immigrants are not harmful, but then I think the more interesting conversation and the part that we in some ways never get to is why they're positive. So,
right.
So it's very different to say they're not negative than to say they're net positive.
But let's
start
with not
negative. Let's start with
because
not
that's
negative.
The part that's really hard for people to wrap their minds around.
That's
you talk about a carpenter here in Philadelphia who sees folks, day laborers, taking work from carpenters. And he says, how could this not be a net negative for me?
Yeah. My carpenter friend is really emblematic of that, right? He, you know, he's a very skilled carpenter. He gets paid very well for his work. But he worries about those day laborers. He thinks they undermine him. And it seems to make sense, right? Because if you think, well, here we are in Philadelphia and there's more carpenters that come in. Aren't they competing for the same jobs as I am? And isn't that going to undermine my wages? And so I can see the intuition. But it turns out when you look at the facts, it just does not happen. In fact, immigrants are net job creators. Now, at first, you'd think, well, why can't that can't be, right? They can't be.
Supply and demand. How
supply
could that
and
be?
Demand. The laws of supply and demand must be wrong. Well, the problem is that the argument is based on thinking only about supply but not demand.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Because what happens is, yes, there's now a greater supply of, say, carpenters in Philadelphia. But what happens when hundreds or thousands of immigrants move to Philadelphia? They also need food, housing. They need schooling. They need entertainment. They want to go to a restaurant and eat. So all of that has to grow to accommodate the growing population. So demand for goods and services is growing. So you just have a bigger pie, which needs, you know, yes, more people eating the pie, but also more people building the pie to begin
exactly.
with. Right? But it's not just that you have a bigger pie. To continue the analogy, I don't know if this is going to work. You also have pies of entirely different flavors that show up.
Right.
Because the techniques and the skill sets that the foreign carpenters bring are different than what my, you know, native-born American carpenter has. They might do different jobs. Because they don't speak English well, my carpenter friend is the foreman, and the other carpenters, you know, might do the parts of the work that don't require English skills. And so what happens is you also have not just more people, but people who kind of allocate into different roles in the economy.
It creates a sort of dynamism.
Yeah, exactly. I'll give you another example. So imagine you're walking through your supermarket aisle and think of the things that you buy every day, right? And if we start removing the things that were the foods that were introduced by immigrants just to Philadelphia, at least half of your cart would be empty.
Yep.
Right? Pasta.
Yeah.
You know, pierogies, sushi. I almost can't think of an American food that doesn't exist because newcomers brought it, right? And so all of a sudden, it's not that, you know, all these foods compete with each other. They just kind of broaden your palate,
yep.
right? And so there's now room for restaurants and producers to offer all these kinds of foods. Anyway.
All of that consumption stemming from immigration at some point along the way.
Exactly. And that's why it's not zero sum.
Yep.
Yeah, it expands. If you are just tuning in, we're speaking about the real impact of immigration on our economy and culture with Zeke Hernandez, professor at the Wharton School and author of the forthcoming book, The Truth About Immigration. If you have a question or comment about the immigration debate and the effect of immigrants on our economy, you can call us. The number is 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org. And Zeke, I think about Philadelphia and how Philadelphia, the population here was stagnant for decades. And in, you know, the early 2000s, we saw this influx of immigrants moving into this country. And for the first time in over a generation, we saw, you know, population growth. Can you talk about how immigration helps take stagnant populations, stagnant economies, and the impact of this flux of new people, what it does for a city like a Philadelphia?
Yeah, exactly. So Philadelphia went from single digits in terms of the fraction of immigrants in the population to today about 15% of Philadelphia's population is foreign born. And it's not a coincidence that that has coincided with an economic renaissance of sorts for our city. Why? And this is where we go from talking about just the not negative to the why immigrants are positive economically. Immigrants are 80% more likely than natives to start a business. So when you get foreign-born people, they're starting new businesses, okay? Everything from the new corner restaurant or the corner store selling, you know, remittances and calling cards to high-tech businesses. Look, we wouldn't be having this show were it not for immigrants, right? The microprocessors that make it possible for us to communicate, introduced to the U.S. Largely by immigrants. If you had a Zoom meeting today, that's an immigrant-started business. The COVID vaccine that allows us to gather and not still be under a pandemic, essentially discovered by immigrants, right? So all of these new things just create vibrancy in the economy. The other thing that immigrants do, and this is one of the great untold stories about immigration that I hope people get it, it's that immigrants increase the amount of investment in your community. So without investment, you can't create jobs, you can't create new businesses. So investment is the beginning of economic growth. And immigrants increase investment in two ways. One is they act as a magnet for investment from their home countries,
right?
So if you have like, you know, Germans that move to the U.S., German firms are more likely to invest in the U.S. And, you know, the same for any other nationality. The other is that in starting businesses, they put their own capital into the economy or they raise capital from other sources to grow that business, right? Whether it's venture capital, private equity, or whatever grows a business. And so the seeds of economic growth are often planted by immigrants through the investment they attract.
You mentioned in the book the example of this restaurant called Pollo Campero, which I grew up with because I was in the Maryland suburbs, and there were many immigrants from El Salvador and Guatemala, and all of a sudden Pollo Campero started popping up, you know, all around us. It's like some of the best chicken I don't do chicken anymore, but it's some of the best chicken you've ever had in your life. And it became very popular first, of course, with the immigrant community. But then people like me started hearing about it and going to Pollo Campero.
Yeah.
And I think you say it goes from the Sanchez's to the Smiths, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so there is like this chain effect. I do have to bring in this question, though, from Alan, anticipate in the book and you knew you were going to get it. Are both legal and illegal immigrants beneficial to the economy? Do you differentiate among them? And you do in the book, and you do address this question, so I'll let you take it.
It's a great question. Alan, right? Alan, thank you for asking the question. It's a great question. It's a fair question. It's always the first question. But you can't make sense of the question without covering some of what we already covered, right? Because if you don't understand the effect that immigrants have on our economy and our culture, which we haven't covered, you can't make sense of what illegal or undocumented immigrants do. The short answer is that from an economic standpoint, there is no difference. The economy doesn't care, right? Whatever your documented status is, you can bring a new idea. You can bring in new tastes and preferences, et cetera. And so from an economic standpoint, it doesn't matter. It does matter in one way, is that by not being documented or legal, you do have a limit into how much you can do. For example, my barber is an undocumented immigrant, and he's very, very good. He's actually won a lot of awards internationally for his work, but he's not documented here. One time he was cutting my hair and I just about fell off my chair. He told me that his dream, we have a very good rapport. He said, my dream is to start my own barbershop. He said, I have $200,000 in cash saved, ready to start my own business, but I can't because I'm not legal, right? And so they bring all the same benefits, but the fact that they can't fully participate in the economy because they're undocumented limits the upside of what they can contribute. Having said that, my claim isn't that it's good for immigrants to be illegal or that it's good for the law to be broken. I think the most important question is, why do we have such a large undocumented population, right? We have about 11 to 12 million undocumented immigrants in this country. When you have that many illegal immigrants or undocumented immigrants, it's not just a matter of a few bad apples. It's that our whole system for bringing apples into the U.S. is messed up,
right?
We don't even replace the number of working-age Americans who die every year with immigration, let alone retirees and all, right? And so when our system of allowing people in is so far removed from the economic needs that our country has, you're going to get irregular immigration, right?
Yeah.
It's just going to happen. So we need to fix the system. So undocumented immigration isn't good, but it's our fault. It's our legal system's fault that the problem exists.
But don't you also go on to argue in the book, because, and this is not undocumented necessarily, but people make this association, you do differentiate between low-skill, middle-skill, high-skill immigrants and their impact on the economy, their net contribution.
Sure.
And it does show that low-skill immigrants are sort of better net contributors to the economy than low-skill native workers. Is that correct? Is my understanding correct?
I would just change one word, not better, but just different.
Okay.
Different net contributors and positive net contributors. Of course, we all want, you know, I use the analogy of like, we all want more Ferraris in our economy, but we need a lot of like Toyotas and Hyundais as well, right?
Yeah.
So for example, undocumented immigrants, or actually, sorry, let's go to unskilled immigrants without college degrees, many of whom are undocumented, but not exclusively. They do jobs that Americans simply don't want to do, right? One example that I find very stark is North Carolina, 2011. Farmers there have 6,500 job openings. We're still in the aftermath of the financial crisis, so there's 500,000 North Carolinians unemployed, 500,000. And only 238 of them apply for farm jobs. 137 of them show up for the first day, and only 7 finish the harvest.
Wow.
I mean, it's just ridiculous. Americans just don't want farm jobs. So who has to come do them? It's immigrants. And that's the same is true for, you know, household services, a lot of construction jobs, a lot of kind of low-end manufacturing. These are jobs that are essential for our economy to function. Someone has to do them. And immigrants are just not competing with natives for them. So it's their toehold. They're kind of their first step into climbing into the American dream. And the other thing, I hope I'm not being too long-winded here, but research also shows that that actually benefits unskilled American workers, because as immigrants take these sort of starter jobs, it allows American unskilled workers to shift into positions that favor their language skills and other other skills. Yeah. And actually, those skills pay more. So the research shows that the more immigrants you have in a state that are doing low-skilled work, the more the wages of unskilled natives go up.
And Zeke, I want to talk about this transition period when people come to this country and, you know, we have this influx of migrants coming to America and there's all this negative rhetoric. But I thought that the town of Hazleton, Pennsylvania, is a great example because it was once a struggling coal city that was on the decline. A wave of Latino immigrants came to town. But the story, Zeke, had a very dark, violent, racist start before they got to this bright side. Can you walk us through that?
Yeah, this is a story that I learned from Andrew Seeley. He's the president of the Migration Policy Institute, so I'll give him credit for that. Hazleton, yeah, a classic Rust Belt town, as you said, was declining. What happened is that, if you'd walked the streets of Hazleton in the 80s, it would have been really depressing, right? Shuttered shops, closed factories. In the 90s, a wave of Hispanic immigrants, mainly from Mexico, kind of moved from New York looking for lower cost of living. Yeah, and it was kind of a precedent to all the debate we're having right now. The residents of Hazleton were very angry. They claimed that immigrants were increasing crime, changing the culture, undermining, you know, the economy, taking jobs. And by the way, Hazleton still has a lot of problems. But unexpectedly, these immigrants did, well, not unexpectedly if you know the evidence. First, they started their own small businesses. And now there are four factories in the Hazleton area, all of which have been open with Mexican capital and are creating jobs there. Now, it's no coincidence that Mexican capital followed Mexican immigrants.
That's the magnet effect you talked about earlier.
That's the investment effect.
And then they hired Americans.
Of course, yeah.
So
like overwhelmingly, there's jobs for Americans. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I do have to bring in this email from Jason because it's another thing you address in the book and you do address it head on. While I can't disagree with the long-term economic impact of immigration, how do you address the current and substantial financial costs associated with dealing with resettling the recent influx of immigrants to cities like Denver and New York? And you admit there's nuance here. For local economies in the short term, this can be a hit and a burden to taxpayers. True.
No doubt, Jason. Yeah, good point. And it's the right question. We need to figure out how to solve this. The numbers are clear that in the short run, places that receive large and unexpected inflows of immigrants suffer costs, right? The immigrants in the short run, and by short run, I mean months or maybe the first year or two, they cost states a lot. You have to educate the children, provide temporary housing, healthcare.
Real quick, though, you mentioned children. That surprised me. I thought that the cost would be emergency housing. You say the biggest cost, right, is public education for the children.
The biggest cost, that's right. So a good estimate is that it costs a state. So a first-generation immigrant costs the state, on average, $1,600. This is assuming all the costs are borne immediately anyway, some complex finance issues. And that's primarily because of the cost of educating children, because immigrants have more children than natives on average. So we have to figure that out because the problem is really that the federal government has taken no action. Right?
The costs are inequitably distributed, and there's no defraying of the costs on the federal level.
Exactly. Okay. So when Mayor Adams of New York or the mayor of Denver complains, they have a point. I mean, they're saying things that aren't totally true, but that's a fair point. Right. Their localities are bearing a disproportionate share of the costs, and there's no scheme for the U.S. government to reimburse or help cover those costs. Mm-hmm. However, this is what we have to keep in mind. In the long run, localities are better off by welcoming immigrants, fiscally speaking. So the children and grandchildren of immigrants bring more than about double the fiscal benefit compared to what the cost is of the first generation. But, that takes a long time. We're talking decades, right? So it's very fair for a mayor to say, well, yeah, but, you know, I have to bear the short-term cost
right now. Yeah,
it's very fair. But this is, again, this is not just the president not doing anything, because the president doesn't have the authority to do everything that needs to be done. Congress has to act and pass a scheme to reimburse and help localities. And the problem is our political stalemate doesn't allow that.
Before we let you go, yeah. I want to bring in the counterfactual example,
sure.
which is, let's say, an advanced economy that does not have a lot of immigrants and an aging population. The country I often think about is Japan. I don't know if they're the perfect one or not, but that's the thing that always rings in my mind. What happens if we just turn off immigration? What happens to a society? What happens to an economy? Because some people would certainly want to do that. What happens if we become, as you put in the book, an immigration beggar?
Well, we know what happens. So look, Japan is actually the perfect poster child and warning signal for America. But we actually know what happens in America itself. Mm. In 1924, one of the reasons this book was written is because we're exactly 100 years from the 1924 National Origins Act. That act essentially shut the door of immigration in America, with very few exceptions. And what happened? We have evidence that the innovation machine of the U.S. suffered. American inventors were nearly 70% less productive. American businesses patented over 53% less. Jobs were lost for native workers. To this day, places that suffer the decline of immigrants the most from the 1924 law have fewer investment ties to the rest of the world.
Wow.
Okay. Now, the other thing that happened in the intervening years is we had the baby boom, and you know the rest
helped
of the world.
Yeah.
The rest of the world was destroyed by World War II. So you could say, well, didn't America thrive? Yeah, but those were very weird conditions.
Well, that's why I bring up Japan, though, because that does seem like a society that if they don't get an influx of immigration could have some real economic imbalance.
And they've become immigration beggars. They're desperate to create a foreign worker scheme. Mm. We're going to be in the same position if we don't get our act together.
And we only have about a minute left. But if you in 30 seconds could have a few policies, what would be the one thing that America could do to actually be more of a welcoming place for immigrants?
Remove the Department of Homeland Security as the one responsible for immigration. Give it to an agency that frames immigration positively. The rest kind of goes from there.
Interesting. That is Zeke Hernandez, professor at the Wharton School, author of the forthcoming book, The Truth About Immigration. Comes out, Zeke, June 4th. Look for that, June 4th. It's called The Truth About Immigration. Coming up next, Cherry?
Yes. Well, we are very excited. We have the pioneering hip-hop choreographer, Rennie Harris, in the studio with us. We'll be right back. We're excited about this. Yes.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back into Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arid, and let's travel back to 1991. A new show debuted here in Philadelphia on television, all about hip-hop music, culture, and dance. It was called One House Street.
Yo, John, kick it, baby!
3, 2, 1, ah!
Yo, it's time to go. Do the show that's gonna make you go crazy. Put your inner days, G. So throw up your hands, give it up, and dance. Do the hit that's gonna make you move your feet. One House Street.
I love it. That host you heard there saying, kick it, baby, was a young Rennie Harris. The dance pioneer was there as hip hop crossed over to the mainstream. Now, a lot has changed in the 3 decades since, but one thing that has remained, Rennie Harris, the choreographer, is still one of the most influential people in hip hop dance, leading its rise from the street to the stage.
Philadelphia native Rennie Harris joins us now in studio. His legendary dance company, Pure Movement, will perform at Penn Live Arts this weekend for a show that looks back over the past 30 years. And we're going to do a little reminiscing now. Rennie Harris, welcome to Studio 2.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going good.
Good. Yeah.
We're having a good time.
I know.
Think, yeah.
I went into the crates. So.
Yeah.
We went into the crates. Had to do it. And kudos to you, 30 years of Rennie Harris, Pure Movement. That's amazing.
Yeah, someone told me it was 30 years, and I was like, oh, It has been 30 years, you know.
So. And so I want to, you know, sort of start the conversation, Rennie, by going back in time. I saw a piece where you said originally you wanted to be a priest, but then started popping and fell in love with dance. Take us back to the beginning. What was it like falling in love with movement at a time of creativity when hip hop was being born?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, specifically in the African-American and brown community, you know, movement, and I'm just speaking from that perspective. I'm sure there's other folk who have movement as part of their culture. And so you don't think of it as an extracurricular activity. You just kind of do it, that kind of thing. So things were happening without us realizing things were happening. And so prior to it being called hip hop, nobody called it anything. Right. It was just like this new thing, you know, that young kids were doing, that we were doing at the time.
And what drew you to it?
Well, you know, it morphed. So it wasn't it's coming out of the culture. Right. So it's not really anything outside of the culture to kind of look at it as like, oh, I like that. I'm going to be a part of that. Right. It's actually just it's developing without us knowing.
Organic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I got to ask you, what makes hip hop dance? Like, what are some of the elements of the movement that makes it part of the art form?
Well, you know, we like to say that, you know, when we talk about hip hop dance, we're talking about basically popular party social dances that were done prior to hip hop, to rap, prior to getting on the radio. And so these particular dances that we may know as the Cabbage Patch, the Running Man, the Smurf, those are all hip hop dances. Everything else is maybe a street dance, right? It's meaning street being a nickname for community dance, right? So crumping is crumping. It's not hip hop. Popping is not hip hop. Breaking is not hip hop. House is not hip hop. Campbell locking is not hip hop. Jitting is not hip hop. Juking is not hip hop. All in, I can keep going on. Turfing is not hip hop, right? These are all different community dances around the country. However, hip hop itself is specifically from the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, and now it's moved in 21st century with the newer dance, like the Millie Rock and all that kind of stuff.
Wow. So when I said popping, I was wrong, because that's not necessarily part of hip hop.
It's associated with hip hop culture, but popping comes from funk. It's a West Coast style. And so hip hop hadn't been invented when popping was being done. Right, everybody was dancing to Parliament Funkadelic, Zap, you know what I mean, that kind of thing. And so on the West Coast, they were like, some of the older cats, like, we never heard of hip hop. Like, what is that? And why are we part of that? Wow. Because they only danced to funk music. Breaking was done to funk music as well. But, you know, B-Girl Asia One, she says that breaking is the cultural dance of hip hop culture. And so it's the thing that helped propel it. But, you know, when we were breakers, we didn't call ourselves hip hoppers. We didn't call ourselves, when we're poppers, don't call themselves hip hoppers. They call themselves what it is. If I'm a popper, I'm a popper. If I'm a breaker, I'm a breaker. If I'm a hip hopper, I'm a hip hopper.
What was the inspiration to form Pure Movement? Like, why did you think, let me use this format of expression?
Money.
Oh. Keep it real, Rennie.
Explain that.
It was economics. You know, I had toured with the first rap tour across the country in 1983, 84. And that was the Fresh Festival, Run DMC, Fat Boys, Curtis Blow, LL Cool J, all those cats, right? I got off tour, came back, and Michael Pedretti at Movement Theater International on 36th Street commissioned me $1,500 to create my own work in the theater. I had no clue why he did that.
He came up to you. You weren't trying to.
No, he called me. I thought it was a white dude on the phone, a black dude. One of my friends trying to pretend like they were white on the phone, and so I was arguing and being really rude to this guy. And then I realized, oh, this is a real call. This is like a real person.
Really wants to pay me $1,500 bucks. Okay,
In advance, 1 year, which I was like, I don't know. Right, I had never been paid in advance before. Normally, you have to fight at the end to get your money.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
But that's how it started. So I didn't have an idea or a vision or, you know, concept. For some reason, I think it could have been I did a lot of work at the Painted Bride with different styles of dance with modern dancers, you know, Japanese kabuki dancers. Lenny Seidman from Painted Bride played a tabla, and I would do sort of this, not abstract popping, but I would pop to all these different things, you know, different type of aesthetics. Zakir Hussain, the famous tabla player. And so I think that Michael Pedretti saw some of this and said, hey, let's...
There's something here.
Well, I mean, also, too, we were a very famous popping group here in Philadelphia called the Scanner Boys.
Yeah.
Right? And so people kind of knew us from that as well. So I don't know exactly what inspired him to give me, to commission me.
But this pure movement has become its own movement, 30 years. As some of the people you started it with sort of fell off, you continued to dance. Mm-hmm. When did you know that pure movement had staying power and got you here today?
Not ever.
You're still not sure?
Honestly, I feel like I'm still like, oh, man, how are we going to survive this next year? How are we going to push forward? And that, you know, honestly, I have to put my take my hat off to Penn Live Arts because they said, hey, you have never been a resident company in this city. And so they were like, we want you to be a resident company in the city. What that means, they're contracted to... you know, obligated more or less to support me, to present the work that I'm doing. And we were traveling the world. You know, we were ambassadors for Obama, for hip-hop ambassadors for in the Middle East for like a month or so. Mm. We were doing all this stuff, but not here in Philly. And no one was really stepping up. And not to, I love my city. I'm not putting anybody down, but Penn Live Arts stepped up and said, you know, here we go.
So it's still a fight in some ways. For what is it? Is it respect, establishment?
Well, you know, street dance and the theater also, too, when you think about it, as Americans, right, we're 15 years behind everyone else. Japan, Europe, you know, everybody, Croatia, they all have street dance theater, and it's massive.
Really?
There's probably maybe 10 to 15, and I'm being generous by saying 15 street dance theater companies in this country. It's not really that much. And so in many ways, I like to say, you know, black and white, however you identify that, we are sort of elitist about how we want to receive hip hop, how we want to see it.
And we don't want to see it like ballet, like jazz.
Right, right. It's already, like yeah, right. We're already in our head like how we want to view it as entertainment. And so it was one of the reasons why I decided to stay in the theater, because I stopped wanting to entertain and I wanted to sort of like as edutain or provoke people to think, to look at, to view street dance completely different than the way that they view it.
And we only have a couple more minutes for this segment, but I got to ask you, what would it do for hip hop dance to take it to that next level where hip hop dance is studied like a ballet, like a jazz, like a tap?
Well, it's studied now. I'm also a professor at University of Colorado, Boulder. There are well over 600 courses in hip hop in higher education. Some you can get a certificate, some you can get, you know, your actual degree. However, I think we still need support from our own folk, because we don't have a foundation. The hip hop rappers are not supporting us the way that ballet may get support. Mm. Right? There's no academy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I started my own university online called Rennie Harris University.
Where you train people.
Well, I teach them the history. Hmm. Well, we online, they get lectures for 6 months, and then they come together and learn technique. So we learn the history of street dance culture, starting from enslavement all the way up to now.
Wow.
But you might be looking for, like, you know, endowment type of support from, like, a major music star.
Yes, yes.
So, like, that's so interesting.
Because if we had that, then... we would thrive.
We could grow it.
Right. There's so many different, in my company, there's a bunch of members who started their own company and are now teaching in the universities, but we don't have enough to support that growth.
Thank you, Rennie Harris, for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Studio too. Rennie Harris, Pure Movement American Street Dance Theater has shows this weekend at Penn Live Arts. Check it out.
Definitely check it out. And that, friends, is it for today. Our show is produced by Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes. Al Banks is our engineer. This is Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman. Aaron, we have a listener comment asking us what a courtesy tow is. I can't tell you in 15 seconds, unfortunately. You'll have to Google it. We will be back tomorrow on Studio 2 on WHYY. See you then.